The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am here with Corey Mio from Mio Vineyards in his home in Beamsville, looking out at his row upon rows of his vineyard. It is a gorgeous Wednesday afternoon, October 15th. I don't know why I've just given the full date, but here we are. Corey, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'm going to start here by ripping off what I believe Rick Van Sickle said. Rick Van Sickle, interviewing you, talking about your winery, said 8 years ago, Corey hadn't even tried a glass of Niagara wine, let alone harbored visions of buying a vineyard in the heart of the region. Corey, what the hell happened 8 years ago to get you to where we are now?
It's been a journey of twists and turns. I would say that like our shared story kind of involves like our romantic weekend out here to Niagara to get away. You know, I was living at home at the time, and my now wife, she was an older, more established, classy woman. My family had suggested, well, you know, you should take her for something nice. Why don't you take her to Niagara and do what? I mean, we've all been to the falls. My parents are like. my parents were like, well, no, there's tons of wineries that you should go check out. I'm like, wineries? Like making like European wine, you know, like Italian wine? I mean, we came out here and I was, you know, just blown away. Like it was like my first experience with something that felt, you know, so familiar. You know, I'd spent a lot of summers like, in Europe as a kid, and kind of grew up in like that sort of tradition in our household as well. Couldn't believe that something like that was so close to home. And I was just smitten with some of the, exciting and delicious things that were being made here. And Lena and I spent more time together. We would just come out here, you know, very, very frequently. She lived in Oakville, so it wasn't a hard commute to come out here when I was going to stay with her for the weekend anyway.
Now, you grew up though with wine, like in your household, but more old world, more European wines, was just part of, you know, dinners and meals?
Yeah, no, 100%. I wouldn't say it was old world per se. I'd say that the winemaking was old world, because we would just buy grapes that were trucked in from California and
who's we? Like your family made wine?
Oh yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like me and my dad, my nonno, and my brother. Yeah, our entire lives. I mean, I didn't enjoy, because I thought that was what all wine tastes like, and not that it was bad, but that it, you know, it got a little much when I'd like, you know, just prefer to, you know, often have a beer with my friends.
I'm usually good on my research. I did not know your family made wine. How would you describe the best family wine you guys ever made and the worst family wine you ever made?
And I think my nonno would agree too, that the best wine, family wine that we ever made was when I actually went out and picked the grapes with him from the place, and we would try them together first. Yeah, that was shortly after we had moved here to the farm. So
okay,
I think it's only gotten better from there, you know?
Okay, so you guys made wine from grapes sourced from the Niagara region.
No, we're talking like going to a place at like Keel and Lawrence in a parking lot, you know, at a Walmart, going to get, you know, the seasonal grapes trucked in from California.
And, gotcha.
You know,
okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there was no Niagara grapes purchased at that time. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'd be much younger. That would be like, what, 20 years ago or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, even up until, just prior to us like really planting our vineyard, you know, that was still kind of the case, because that was more just for my grandparents and my parents. Right. And that was like, you know, the everyday drinker. Yep. And they would have a couple of demijohns in the basement, and, you know, we'd spend a day and go buy the grapes, bring it, crush it, press it, you know, my nonna would take care of the rest.
First off, that's very nice. Like that, it just brings the family together and having that sort of that shared passion and also that shared time. But see, now this makes a lot more sense, because the idea of, because people need to know, you just gave me a tour of the vineyards, and you went through how, you know, you guys bought this property and you were doing all this work on your home, and you were moving, you're removing forest or you're clearing space and you're planting vineyards. This is an incredible amount of work. And this is also a massive financial investment where you don't reap any money back for a long time. It's the delightful economic nature of winemaking. And I'm thinking to myself, where did this come from? It couldn't have just been a romantic trip to Niagara. But see, now it makes more sense. Wine and winemaking is part of your family. Now, Corey, now this makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, yeah, maybe it skipped a generation from my nono to me, for sure.
Right.
You know, I loved the tradition of doing that. I didn't necessarily enjoy as much end product, but hopefully, you know, we're going to have a lot of time here to master that and, you know, have our own land. And I think it's been important, not just for, you know, for Lena and I and our story, but for our family as well, to have that, you know, it's very meaningful, because I know that my nono's side, their ancestors had land, and they had, you know, at one point prior to the war, you know, they had their vineyards and would harvest their stuff. And it's funny. I asked my nono, do you remember like what varieties you were growing there? Cause he's in Friuli, and I thought it would have been something cool, like indigenous or like, you know, I don't know, Taraldego or I don't know, Pignolo or something cool.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, of course, Baco Noir.
Really?
Like, stop. Oh, no.
No, it can't be Baco Noir.
I think coming out of, and so I know, Baco Noir and Malbec apparently.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
In Friuli,
yeah.
Baco Noir, yeah. And Malbec.
Yeah, no, that's what, yeah. Yeah, and it's not like his memory's going, like, he's good.
Yeah,
you know,
he
would know. Yeah.
That is not testable. You could never on a quartermaster exam, you know, what's this? Oh, I think this is a Friuli Baco Noir. There's no way anyone would, that would be just cruel to put that on there. So then take me to first the decision between you and your girlfriend at the time this is a massive life-changing undertaking, what you guys decided to do.
We were just like looking for a place to get together, and we were looking at the city, and it felt like there wasn't a lot of value there at the time. It was already
what year was this around about?
Oh shoot, like 2016,
okay.
2017.
Okay. Yep.
2017 was. I mean, that was the year we moved here, but it would have been early 2017, late 2016. And you know, she was working. She had gotten a new job at John Deere in Grimsby, so she was close to here, and we were. You know, whatever. We felt a connection. She's got family in the area. I just like thought, why don't we look at getting a farm and trying this? And I remember, you know, she tells the story better than I do, but she was like, Are you fucking nuts?
Yeah.
Like you don't have any business being a farmer. Come on, man, you know how much work this is? And I was like never intimidated by the work. You know, I kind of grown up in a working class kind of blue collar, you know, setting like my whole life, right? So I was like, yeah, it's extreme gardening. Like, yeah, we can get a couple acres and just do it. You know, people do it on nights and weekends. That's what everybody does, right? If the monks can make, you know, fine Burgundy, we have the internet. What's to be scared of, right? And besides, we can get this property that's got two houses and all this land for the cost of a teardown house in Toronto. Like, why wouldn't we, or whatever, or a brand new townhouse in Burlington? Like, why wouldn't we capitalize and try and, if we're going to swing for the fences, go for that? Because don't know if we'll ever get another chance. And now, the way things are, man, like, there's no way we could have done it in today's environment. Like, we just got lucky with timing.
Just, it'd be way too expensive.
Yeah.
If your origin story, if you'd come for your first visit in 2023, then that would have been unsustainable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, in our current, predicament, for sure.
So I want to ask what your itinerary was like during your first year. But let's talk about what's the first wine. There's three wines. There's a Marsan, and then there's two different Chardonnays. We're going to first start with the Rhone varietal. What do we need to know about the Marsan here?
We had the opportunity to plant Marsan in 2020. We were inspired to do so when we saw it on like the nursery's repository list, because Kew Vineyards is like a couple hundred meters away from our house, and they were the first ones to plant Marsan. And we always really enjoyed that. And frankly, like, what I gravitate towards for my own palate is like full-bodied textured whites. And I think Niagara does them well.
Yep.
And we just jumped on it. We're like, yeah, let's do it. So we planted an acre of Marsan. And I had known that they always blended a bit of Viognier in there. And I thought, just in my research, that kind of what Marsan might lack, Viognier could kind of compensate for. So we planted one little row of Viognier beside the acre of Marsan to blend in together and co-ferment. And that's this wine.
I can say, just even just having a smell, this smells full bodied, like this exactly. But then you can get the Viognier. The interesting thing is, in my research, you are self-taught. Like, we were laughing before, but that's what, you know, you said it, the monks, and we have YouTube and all of that.
Like, you and podcasts too, eh?
And what?
Podcasts.
Yeah, and podcasts. But you do not follow the traditional hero's journey of a winemaker, do you?
I mean, I wouldn't even call myself a winemaker per se. Like, we'll have our hands in everything. Like, there's not one thing that I think we haven't participated in or had not like tried to like just like do ourselves. But I, like any good enterprise, it takes a team, man. Like, we have great neighbors and great friends, and some of the same people that we sell our grapes to make their wine, you know, they'll help us make ours, right? That's, you know, that's the way it is.
Honey, nutty, oily in the right way. If someone said this is Marsan, I probably would just immediately call that this is Rhone. Like that, that's a, what's the blend? That's a, by the way, an excellent wine. Like, and especially for people that want to get out of Chardonnay, but they don't want to leave too far. This wine here is sort of a perfect, hey, come on over here. You know, you'll be safe. You'll enjoy this. This is like a perfect wine for people that want to try something that's not Chardonnay.
Yeah. So the splits on that are more, it's like 85% Marsan, 15 mm-hmm. VO. Like, in the future, I'd like to dial back a bit of the Viognier, but it happens that, you know, we kind of share a bit of that Marsan block with some of our other friends and clients. Percentages on the weights for that year, that's kind of what it worked out to. And
yeah, the white floral, white peach, golden honeysuckle. I always say honeysuckle, which always sounds silly because I don't remember the last time I was ever on honeysuckle or honeysickle, whichever honey it is. What for you, when you're describing this wine as someone that's just dipping their toe in it, what would you say?
I mean, I strive to be like, or I think like what our goal is in our winemaking is just like classical and elegant wines. Mm-hmm. It's what we like to drink. And yeah, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I think in terms of like impact, we have way more of an impact in like the way we grow our grapes than in necessarily in the winemaking. Like, I would say like we kind of emulate the same style as, you know, Thomas Batchelder, Kelly Mason, Cloudsley, that sort of semi low interventionist style with like, you know, wild ferments, you know, judicious use of French oak.
What was life like for you the first, let's say the first 500 days after you bought this property?
First 500 days.
Oof. I just wonder like how long the days were. I just really just want to hear about the struggle, the hurdles.
Yeah, there was a lot of tree clearing, man. That was like goal number one is get, and that's probably not going to make some of your listeners too happy. It's just hearing about clear cutting, but it's, we had strands of like old pines, because I think at one point there was a program.
I'm going to interrupt. You weren't clear cutting to put up a mall or a gas station. the work you were doing here is incredibly respectful of the land. So, you know, it's not like you're not the evil 80s movie villain putting up the condo and knocking down the orphanage.
True. But, you know, at the same time, it's, you are doing like a mono farming, right? It's a single crop as opposed to like a holistic enterprise, right?
Mm-hmm. How hard is it to take down a tree?
Not that hard when you have a forklift or a backhoe, mm-hmm. right? Not that hard at all. So I would say it's more controlling the fires from when we burnt all the trees, because it helps when your neighbor is in good with the fire department here, because I think we contravened a few bylaws with some of the the fires that we had here at that time.
How much, I want to say it's easier, but what is a typical day for you today? I shouldn't say typical day, because it all depends on the season. A dumb question. How different is a October day in 2025 than what an October day was, say, in 2020 or 19?
Those were still really busy days. They were just different. Now you know, there's even more responsibility, but it's like, it's even more outside of like the wine industry. You know, we have a child now, which we didn't have back then in October of like 2019 and 2020.
So you decided to get busier with your life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Like take on even more, you know, right during, you know, a global health crisis. it was serendipitous timing, I guess. And, you know, we survived. Right. And, you know, are thriving.
You talk a lot about neighbors. How important that these wines and the success you've had, how much of it is traced to just to friends and neighbors and to everyone around you?
I mean, there's so many people that have had a hand in our success. And our families have been like so incredibly supportive just with their time, right? Especially in the beginning, like it helps having a forklift, but somebody's got to man the chainsaw too, right? So It's been a real community effort. Like, you know, my 90-year-old nonno was out here picking Cabernet Franc with us this morning, right? And riding his lawnmower around with my, and then he delivered the grapes with my brother to, you know, where at Mary Neeson where we're processing, and Lena's out there right now on the crush pad. Mm-hmm. So while we're doing this interview, right? So, you know, everyone's got a hand, right? And even, Mark Pistor was kind enough to come because we were running heavy on the tonnage to run over here with his trailer so we could bring it all back together to the pad, right? Like, we're extremely lucky. Like, I think also our entanglements in terms of supplying grapes and having those relationships on the grower side as well as this wine side, we're all kind of invested in our success in that way, I feel. So, yeah, I could, we, like, Lena and I, we're not trained winemakers or anything like that. Sure, we can like go with my grandfather in a garage and like put it through like a little hand press, and then, you know, he can add a sulfur puck and just watch it in the garage and hope it doesn't go to vinegar, right? But he's been doing it for like 70 years, right, at that time. So yeah, for us, like, this is a commercial enterprise now, right? There's some extremely talented people that have all played a part, right? Jeff Moot of Divergence Wines.
Yep.
He's like the mad scientist, man. Like, that's his, he is the, chemistry whiz, and, you know, technical expertise is great. And Mitch McCurdy down at Mary Neeson and Mark, they're super hardworking guys, and everyone's kind of has a job to do. It's a farm. Even our son's got to go out there and, pull some leaves. He's at the perfect height, you know, in the fruit zone. So in the summers, that's his job.
Your grandfather must love doing this. Your grandfather must. And I know, have no idea. I'm just basing this on our conversations, but he must be thrilled to be helping out here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think besides having a good excuse to get out of the house and away from my grandmother. I mean, I think he just like genuinely loves it. Like, it reminds him, I think, of his home in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this is his home, you know, he still traces his roots, and like all of his ancestors are from Friuli, right?
Yeah. So.
That's where the Mio name comes from. He has a lot of pride, right?
Right.
In what we're doing. And yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. In the last like year or two, he can't even drink wine anymore because of his medication and health. You know, he's health things, right? He's on blood thinners and shit, so the doctors don't like him to have alcohol, right? But, you know, it's in our DNA, man. It's part of who we are, like, you know.
Clearly. Well, actually, before we get to the Chardonnay, and again, that's as someone who is a fan of Rhone whites, that's a great wine.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it fits with a lot of just what I love drinking. I was saying before that, you know, my house, my girlfriend and I, it's Chardonnay and Riesling would be the two top whites that we drink. But I'm wondering for what is the portfolio? If you were explaining your portfolio to someone looking to buy wines from you, what would be the summary of it?
We have the Marsan with a little bit of Viognier in it. And we made two Chardonnays in 23, and that's all that we have on release right now. There's our like regular label, yellow label Chardonnay, and it's kind of like our house style, I guess, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we ended up making a single barrel wine that we called the Primo Mio. Mm-hmm.
And the other ones are the Sempremio and then this Chardonnay. Oh, I can't see because the light's out here. Sorry, so can you say the names of them again?
This is the Sempremio Marsan.
Yep.
This is a Sempremio Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. And this black label one is the Sempremio Chardonnay Primo Mio.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Now I see.
Like our take on a reserve sort of wine.
Okay. Right?
So that's all we have for now. The next, I guess, thing will be 2024's Chardonnays, but those won't be till late fall next year. So this is all we got for a bit. And you know, this year we actually decided to make two red wines in addition to our Chard and our Marsan. And today, right as we're hosting this podcast, we're crushing our Sempremio Cabernet Franc, and we'll also be making a Cabernet Sauvignon in 2 weeks' time.
And that's that was Lena's favorite, was the Franc.
Yeah, so that's like our twin focus. I'm a huge clones nerd. Mm-hmm. And you know, my favorite grape is Chard, and she loves her Cabernet Franc. So we kind of thought, okay, when things with the CFIA and the import rules changed in 2020, you had access to more clones from other places than what was restricted by the government at the time. So we thought, you know, well, we like drinking these grapes in all these other places. Why don't we try growing, a few clones from all over the world, as opposed to like the same three clones that everyone has grown here in Niagara for, 30 or 40 years, right? And that became our focus. So right now we have 13 different clones of Chardonnay from all over the world. And this one that you're going to try next is a blend of 8 of them, because that's what we had producing fruit in 2023 at the time. And we're going to try and do the same thing with Cabernet Franc. Right now we have about 6 clones, and there's several more coming next year.
I think one of the clones I saw is some Corton Charlemagne from Louis Latour. Is that one of the clones you guys have?
There's a cool backstory, because like it's not like none of these things are like advertised like that. So you got to like dig through, you know, internet archives and, you know, written, I don't know, like just art. Yeah. Scientific journals. That's the word I'm looking for, because there was, you know, all kinds of like import restrictions. So yeah, that was a cool find. I ended up piecing together what this random, because this just listed as a number, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And well, what does this number mean? Like, what's the story behind this? Right. So I figured out the story together. This clone was, you know, imported directly from one of the Grand Cru Corton Charlemagne vineyards, because Louis Latour owns 90% of them. And it was done at the behest of Farniente Winery in like the late 1970s, early 1980s. And they had some sort of relationship. So yeah, it had to go through like a long quarantine process in the United States. And then I think there was proprietary status on it for like decades, right? There, I'm pretty sure that's like a common practice in the United States. And then that ended at some point in like the last like 10, 15 years, and a nursery started to grow it. So I would go like, well, you know, in my mind, I was like, that sounds really cool. Like, you know, I've had Farniente before, and it's like, it's pretty rich, and they don't even do malolactic fermentation on that wine. And I'm like, And their wine went from like $10 a bottle in like 1988 to like over $100 now. I'm like, it's on the back of that clone. They planted, I believe, like at least their Rutherford or Coombsville vineyard to it. So I was like, okay, there, that seems to have like a good business case to it. I would like to get this. So yeah, we got it. Nice. And we planted it. And yeah.
Shall we try the first of the two Chardonnays then?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, and how many acres do you have, are you currently farming with?
Planted, we're just shy of 13 right now. Mm-hmm. We have a couple more acres of expanding left to do there on the far east side bordering the creek. So hoping next year, but it depends on what I'm able to get from the nursery to see out our Cabernet Franc clone goals.
You also have both you and Lena still have day jobs, and you're here doing this as well. I mean, how much sleep a night when you guys are in the busy season, which is most of the time, and you have a child, what's the amount of sleep you get a night?
It's better now than when our son was born, because he was a colicky baby, and it was and it was a pandemic, dude. It was not a great time. But yeah, generally we try and sleep pretty good. I'm a big sleep guy, you know. Mm-hmm. I could sleep in the morning and like be a I'll be your best friend at like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, you know, farming and all of our other responsibilities necessitate a more disciplined sort of life, you know?
Yeah, because I imagine you're helping with the pruning, you're helping with the picking, you know, you're helping with the vineyard management. I mean, I guess really the question is, what parts are you not, do your hands not get dirty in?
I no longer do my own sprays. Okay. So I have a friend down the road that helps me, he's got a good recycling sprayer, and he's got some employees. So that's one thing off my I don't know, to-do list.
Mm-hmm. And this is the Lincoln Lakeshore sub-appellation. Is that where we're currently sitting in right now? Is that where we're sitting?
Yeah. We're located like just off of Highway 8. So we're right across the street from the escarpment, the Beamsville bench, kind of right in the heart of it, the middle of it, in the same way that like some other people had said, you know, there's still so much to explore in Niagara, and like terroir is still an open-ended question and we're figuring things out. I'd like to see more discussion and more maybe appreciation for the Lincoln Lakeshore. I feel like it kind of gets really overshadowed by the love of the bench, but that there's so much like nuance and gravitas here in a lot of different interesting little pockets, even though perhaps it's not as homogenous as like all the land in you know, your Beamsville and your 20 Mile. And you know,
who do you sell some of your grapes to?
we've got a number of clients we work with
that you're allowed to share.
I'm
not sure if there's somewhere.
No, there's nothing. Yeah, like, okay. There's no secret deals. Okay. Like that. No, I'm an open book here, Matt. Yeah, we work with Thomas Batchelder. Last year we worked with Tantalus in BC. They were able to procure some of our Chardonnay because they, the
Okanagan Valley
got smoked. Yeah, with a terrible, terrible winter entry. And yeah, we were working. We have a few new clients this year because we have a lot more. A lot more production coming online. You know, we started and, you know, would do only an acre or two every year. So we're kind of just scratching the surface of, you know, almost full production of what we planted so far. So there's Paradise Grapevine in Toronto has been one of our earliest customers as well and clients. And we work with Divergence, like I said. We've worked with Fogelaar, which is Mark Pistor, and we've worked, you know, this year we have a little bit of Cap Franc and Cap Sauve going to Meldville, Derek Barnett, and I think the Good Earth Winery is going to take some Cab Sauve. And this year the majority of our Chardonnay went to Westcott, and I think we're going to be working with them in the future, doing a lot more Chardonnay, you know, collaboration. And
well, I bring that up because you said before that maybe Lincoln Lakeshore sub-appellation deserves a little bit more attention and a little bit more love. Everyone always focuses on bench. Well, you mentioned Thomas Batchelder, maybe the best winemaker in the area. There's about 3 or 4 we can pick from. He's going to be there. Westcott is crazy good. Derek Medville is an absolute genius. And Tantalus is a very well-known high-end Okanagan winery. And they bought grapes from you. I'm just saying, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for the people that are listening to this pod.
Well, yeah, I'm hoping there's a lot of crossover because, you know, a lot of those people that you just mentioned, I believe, have been on your podcast before, right?
Most of them have. And the reason they have is it's a really simple one. I dig their wine. Everything always starts with, do I like your wine? Great. Now I want to hear your whole story. So yeah, I mean, those people are all individuals that make a wide variety of different varietals and all that make incredible wine.
I gotta give a lot of love to Thomas because he took a chance on us like right at the beginning when he was finding all these different sites and terroirs all over Niagara and mapping that out, and he's got a lot of credibility and we had zero. Mm-hmm. You know, and we didn't have any formal education or a network or really any colleagues or friends. Like, it was a really lonely time when we were first starting the vineyard, because right after we planted, the very next year is when the pandemic happened. We lost 2 or 3 years, and you know, it's not like we were getting together to make new friends during that time, you know? So
such a risk. What a, you know, what a massive gamble. I say both good on you and you guys following your passion, and good on your wife, on Lena, following along and trusting and you know, embracing this as well. And also, you guys are dummies. I mean, that is just what a ridiculous thing to do as well. And I mean that as a compliment.
No, it's you know what? I appreciate the sentiment. Yeah, you know what? It's a lot of work, but yeah. Sometimes the rewards are few and far between. But I get to meet and I have met like so many cool people that I otherwise wouldn't have had the chance to, right? Unless we had gone down this road. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's not always about money, man. Like, this gives me a sense of purpose and meaning in my life. Like I'm a grower first and foremost. You know, the wine is secondary. That, you know, with what, how we want to make it, it takes care of itself when it comes in, and it's really good already on the crush pad, right? So that's where I have a lot, you know, a lot of my pride is, and you know, I invite anyone that wants to come over and meet me and have some wine and see the vineyard anytime, you know.
You said more of your house style Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
This meets what you were talking about. I mean, this is a full-bodied Chardonnay. This isn't fat and flabby. You know, it's everything that you want. That this does follow, you know, my style. I love Chablis. I love stainless steel, but I'm still, you know, I like the big, richer, you know, Chardonnays that are still tamped down. You know, like an action movie that has a good script. You know, that's how I want my Chardonnay. I'm fine with a good explosion every now and then, as long as it ties in with good character development and the script is tight.
Well, you said it. Yeah, I mean, we're not afraid of that either. I'm not afraid to use a little bit of new oak. I know that's not necessarily the most fashionable thing to say in some certain circles, but that's what I like. We're a wood family, man. We've made wood our lives, you know, from, you know, would be a fourth generation, you know, framer and woodworker, carpenter, right? So, you know, it's, again, as much as winemaking's in our blood, so is wood. But, you know, you have to be reasonable too, so, and responsible. Like, not that we can afford 100% new French oak for our wines anyway.
By
man.
The way, wouldn't that be wonderful? We just used new French oak once, and then we throw the barrels out. Oh, yeah. Bring us more of them.
Like, give me 14. Like, load the truck, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be good. How would you describe this wine for people? Yeah, just the aromatics, the palate on this fella.
I'm more of like a texture person as opposed to like flavor. And I know that maybe that's a bit of a cop out, but
no.
I feel like this wine speaks to like to us in a lot of ways. And the next Chardonnay we're going to try speaks to like Niagara.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is, yeah, like there's a certain amount of elegant decadence to this wine.
Good way
that
to put it.
It is refreshing, but it is not shy in its voluptuousness and its presentation, I guess, you know? It is, I wouldn't say exactly full throttle, but it would stand out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you're at the LCBO and you're missing your California Shards, this can fit in. And it's not, when I say that, this is not sweet. This is not overly tropical. This is not a mango bomb, but this has the texture of Sonoma. You know, this certainly does. So that's
for sure. That's it's got some weight to it. Yeah.
No. And also, I'm not afraid to admit, I like California Chardonnay. In fact, I love California Chardonnay. Like anything else, I like good California Chardonnay. There's, you know, it's funny. People have to speak about it in hushed tones, you know, like someone saying they like Nickelback. I don't know. Because I don't like Nickelback. This is better than Nickelback. But the point is, people get uncomfortable sometimes saying they like California Chardonnay. For
I don't know
reason.
Why. I mean, like, I didn't grow up drinking Burgundy. Like, we had California Chardonnay. My mom's American, man. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's we drank American wines, right? When we went down all the time, what did we drink? American wines, like California Chardonnay. I'm not trying to emulate that style. I think we have just a wonderful gift here in Niagara as it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just might, you know, have a couple of California clones that perhaps could lend themselves, especially in hot years like this one in Niagara, to more balance than maybe some of your French clones, so... Yeah. But,
you give me a La Crema and a crunchy grouper sandwich. I'm telling you that That's a good 40. That's a good 45 minutes. But yeah, no, excellent Chardonnay. Speaking of vintages, when we were going through, we were trying some of your Cabernet Sauvignon, which can you even answer this now? How long, much longer you're going to let it hang? And again, today is October 15th.
Yeah, I mean, tough to say. I haven't really gotten my sample taken to Brock
yet.
Yeah,
hard to answer that now.
Yeah, like I would want like a certain amount of like just certain parameters as well as hang time, because I think it unfortunately Cab Sauv has a bad rap, amongst some more certain circles in Niagara for being, you know, underripe or full of, you know, bell pepper or pyrazines, because it could never get fully phenolically ripe. And I wonder how much of that could be attributable to overcropping or some certain cultural practices that would not lend themselves favorably to something that ripens so late here. Mm-hmm. I think if you are, could be maybe, you know, at least for me, I'm willing to be a bit more willing to take a little bit less on the crop and maybe spend a little bit more money on the leaf pulling to really aid in that ripening. And
well, what are the yields? Because you told me, and I forgot, your yields are pretty extreme on that Cabernet.
Well, yeah, I cluster thinned it all to one cluster of shoot just to really concentrate it, because, you know, I want to make just a fucking kick-ass Cab Sauv from Niagara and maybe prove a couple people wrong, right? Like, for people, I like steak wine, dude. Like, as much as I like having, you know, champagne and you know, caviar. Or
we can all say we love ethereal, and we do, but a good steak wine is always going to make a night better. No one's going to disagree with that. Everyone quietly, they'll all agree. But for people that don't know, when you say just the one, can you explain again with that yield? If they could put that in perspective for people that might not know just what that means in terms of how much grape you're letting hit the ground.
Oh, geez, way more than half. It wants to push, and the clusters can be big too. I would say at least 50%. If the vines were more mature, because they also are very young, I would say that you would be pushing maybe more like 60 to 65% even.
So that means
cut off, right?
50, like, 60.
You're whatever. Taking a third.
Yeah.
Right?
So all that work and time and energy and money is now going to the ground to make for a better Cabernet. And it seems to me, if you were ever, and you tell me, I'm just going on just me always keeping an eye on the weather in this area. Feels to me 2025, kind of like 2020, the heat is here to allow for these Bordeaux varietals, these Cabernet Sauvignon especially, that it could absolutely work this year.
No, 100%. I mean, I think it probably would have worked even if I didn't crop down to one cluster of shoot, but I don't mind having a little bit extra concentration in that when we weren't really planning on selling that anyway. It's a first fruit off the vine, right? So yeah, this is honestly, it's looking like a gorgeous year for, I think, a lot of things across the board. It's one of those like Goldilocks kind of years, except oddly for Pinot. It's been a weird year for Pinot.
Oh, really? How so?
I don't know why, but as a varietal, like I'm sure you'll speak with other people and you can ask them their experiences. I don't grow Pinot, so thank God I don't have this problem.
This is just from other friends and other colleagues?
Yeah, just from like tons of people. It's been picked so late. I don't know if it was a heat stress thing that stressed them out in the summer or what. But I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I picked Cabernet Franc for Derek at Meldville, and he also got Pinot Noir, three or four like less bricks, which is like, let's say 2%, you know, less alcohol on it. You're normally picking Pinot a month earlier than now, maybe at least 3 weeks, and Cabernet Franc maybe a week later than now, right? For example, I mean, maybe mine is just It's whatever. It just happens to work out. You know, you can't extrapolate from such a small sample size. But there are people that still have not picked their Pinot Noir for their red wine yet. Like, I don't think Hidden Bench. Like,
really?
No. I was talking to another winemaker today, and he had told me, because they're right across from them, and he's like, yeah, I'm ready to pick my Merlot and my Cab Franc, and you know, it's all ready. But yeah, it's been a weird one for Pinot. Everything else is like, I mean the saving grace though is that regardless of having to hang it seemingly so much longer than everything else, like beyond a reasonable time, it's actually been doable because it's been so dry. Like there's not really a lot of rot. So you're not necessarily losing as much by having to just wait and wait and wait and wait for it. I don't know. It's it seems like every year there's like a new first year. Like that doesn't really, I know it's, it because you know, I remember Thomas told me this vintage, he was lamenting like the fact that how do we ever learn anything if every year is different? And I'm like, well, maybe that's just part of the, that's part of the challenge, man. Like, you know, and the humility and knowing that like this is Niagara, this is what Mother Nature gives you. And you just above all have to be adaptable and be humble to it. Right.
Yeah. There's nothing predictable about making wine here. All right, so we'll try your the other Chardonnay. I was going to know the higher end or the, you know, saying like that, but you know, obviously this one is, you know, you put more into this wine. What is the big difference between this Chardonnay and the last one we tried?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there was more of an effort per se. This is like just a true reserve, and like in the sense of like the actual word is reserve. We reserved wine from the main cuvée because this was just a single barrel that stood out to us when we were trying from the rest. And you know, my wife and I ultimately made the decision, but I would blind like my colleagues and friends and just be like, guys, what do you think about this one, man? Like for me, it just like stands out and it's different than the other, its other counterparts in barrel, right? And we thought it would be a shame, like if it wouldn't make the other wine worse, but it would be a shame to lose this just to have it blended in the main cuvée. And you got to think, Matt, these are very low, you know, volume productions, right?
How this much you make, by the way?
This is the yellow label is only 50 cases, you know, and this is only 23 cases.
23 cases, yeah. Of the Reserve Chardonnay, 50.
Oh, the Primo Mio.
The Primo Mio is is 23 cases.
Yeah.
The first Chardonnay was 50.
Correct.
And how much of the Marsan did you make?
Oh, well, this is our second vintage of the Marsan. So we had the 23 that sold through in the summer. So yep. We bottled this. No, thank you. We bottled this about 6 weeks ago and just kind of released it in like the last month during harvest. But I think we made 140 cases.
Okay.
150. Yeah.
So the Marsan is the main one for you guys right now.
Well, we made a lot more in 24 of Marsan just because we had a hunch that, you know, we had the novelty aspect of there's not too much Marsan. We thought we could sell it. It made an interesting product. And, you know, we had already tried it in bottle by the time, you know, we were doing this harvest. And we're like, I don't know. Fuck, man, this is good. Like, you know, maybe we should just do it, right? So we made more, and our clients got a little bit less. So that's c'est la vie.
I imagine the majority, because of the grapes, and we were talking about this before. How much do you guys? And it's hard, like to bottle for yourselves. That's, you know, that's a lot more work, and that means you're not going to see the money for a while. And when you're a small, very independent winery, every dollar counts. What percentage? Mm-hmm. What percentage of the grapes grown go towards your wine versus that you are selling to wineries from Okanagan to all over Niagara?
This year we took on a lot more because we wanted to make the two reds as well. So I would say we sell about 75-80% of what we grow to other clients, and we keep, well, this year we kept about 20-25%, but in the past it was more like 90-10.
Right.
And that's just, there's financial reasons for that. And there's just also like just commitment reasons, right? Like we don't have our own on-site, you know, farm winery here, right? Like we don't have the license or the equipment or anything like that. We've kind of invested in ourselves and in our vineyard, and you eventually we'd like to, like that was always our goal, right? Like, well, we want to get this place and we can build up to it in like 20 years. Maybe we can get like, you know, have the on-site winery, right? Like that's always what we want to do, but we have other jobs, and that's what pays our mortgage. Like it's not the grapes, man. Like that's just you know, that's just a side hustle, you know, to a lot of people, right? Like we can commit our time and our talent and you know, and I can do 1,000 hours of clone research and think this is what's got to go here, and you know, you can do all that work and then Mother Nature's got other things in store for you, right? Like it doesn't you know, that's it. If anything, you know, it's the wine side that is, you know, more profitable than the grape growing 100%, right? Mm-hmm. In this day and age, you know, it's if not for any of the subsidies that would exist, it would be impossible to grow grapes at a profitable level here in Southern Ontario, in Niagara anyway.
You know, Corey, a lot of people's side hustle is doing Uber Eats 3 days a week. So I'm just going to say you picked a little more intensive side hustle. By the way, obviously just more depth on the mid palate and just a much longer linger on the end. Mm-hmm. If I was going to, the first thing that comes to mind, differentiating the first Chardonnay versus the reserve one, that'd be the first thing that comes to mind for me cool. for these two.
I find there's like a bit more of like a creamier texture to this, but it's, I don't know if it's like a fair thing to say, but I feel like it's more autumnal. Like the yellow thing, the yellow shard was the thing that I would have like all summer, because it was like on those hot days, it had a lot of that, I don't know what people like to call minerality, and there's all that acid too to like make it more refreshing, even though there's richness, and it was like your like, you know, guilty pleasure, like sort of like mm-hmm. chuggable summer shard, and like yep. this is the one that like, okay, maybe we can like, you know, like, not that we have a fireplace, but like start a fire, like, you know, and yeah, I don't know. That's just the way I feel about them.
How about,
everyone's got their own interpretation. That's why wine's so fun.
It is. It is fun. My God, it's like one of the funnest things. So the first Chardonnay, that's for the middle of the afternoon. The reserve, that's for watching the sunset. How about that?
Correct.
It's not maybe one way to describe it. What surprised you the most when you started making wine? What were some of the surprises?
All
right. By the way, we only have like six minutes left.
No, right, no, you're great, man. No, I, you know what? I came from, even though it was like a blue collar working class, I came from like a more hustle culture growing up in Toronto. You know, even just my upbringing, and even just being more corporate, I guess, in general, right? Like a professional. And it's not to denigrate all the professionals here in Niagara, but it was a totally different world coming into farming, because it's the mentalities are a lot different, you know?
Yeah.
And I want to say like, sometimes it feels like it's like island time, you know, when you're out here in Beamsville and in Niagara, right? It's a totally different world. I mean, yeah, some of the other challenges, I mean, other than dealing with people, which is always a challenge, you know how people are, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it's just, I was never intimidated by the physical work. The most challenging thing was just, I guess, the more like the mental and emotional side, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, and not just finding balance and not getting so bent out of shape with like things that you can't control, no matter like how hard you or organized or how fucking hard you work or are disciplined to do it all or knowledgeable or like did this thing, and it just like doesn't always like work out that way. I think that's emblematic of the way like grape growing in Niagara is. You have to be nimble, and it's a game of adjustments, right? Like here we got the October Classic coming up. That's the name of the game, man. It's a game of adjustments, because something's going to happen every year that like tests your knowledge and what you're willing to do. And like, I'm like very new to this, you know, like compared to some of the other people that, you know, that have helped me and continue to, that have been doing this a lot longer. And I think the wisest thing that we have done, I guess, in starting this life and business is listening to people that were smarter than us, and not trying to interject, even if we thought we had a better idea. I think there's a lot to be said about the wisdom of people that have been doing it longer than you, if that makes sense.
No, it does. So it's all about learning. It's all about being curious. It's also about being humble and just listening to the other advice and trying to keep your own experiences to the side and working them in. In 2030, what is the realistic best case scenario? Because best case scenario is everyone buys all the wine and we've got the greatest plot of land and we're charging $300 a bottle and they're all selling, which would be a delight. Well, but what like 2030, you know, just a reasonable, where would you like to be with your vineyard, with your line of wine?
Yeah, I think just like healthy organic growth is like is the main goal. I mean, we're not making wine for like, even though I think that they could be appreciated by, you know, a more wealthier or elitist clientele. Mm-hmm. They're priced for like reasonable, you know, consumption, right? Like that's kind of our goal. Like I think that like if we, yeah, just like everyone says, if we had just a wine club list, and that's like an allocation list that gets sold out every year, and it goes directly to like true customers, that like what more could you ask for, right? Mm-hmm. Like people that appreciate it can, you know, and afford it, and it's sold all at retail, and you're sold out every year. Like, you know, these are pipe dreams, right? But you hope, right? I think other than that, our long-term goal, I don't know if it's maybe 2030, probably more like 2035, is to actually have like our own manufacturing facility here. That's right. Definitely our goal.
So just increase the bricks and mortar of what you're doing.
Yeah, I would like to have the control and just eventually transition out of like my day job. I think that's both Lena and I's goals, like long term. We would like to commit more to this. I think that we love what we do. We could be really good at this, man. Like that's the thing, right? If we had, you know, we don't have the certain advantages that perhaps some others do that are getting into this. We have a lot of time, and I feel like we can leverage that to learn a lot about our place that maybe some people might not be afforded that same privilege, right? So, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, considering how far you've come in a short period of time, you know, the thing is the ceiling is so high for you guys. You have the work ethic, you have the passion, you got the family background in it, you're here for the long haul, you know, you're experimenting with Arborino, you're now getting into other reds, you're doing something well with the grapes because you're selling them to people that know what they're doing as well, and I think it's going to be a cool journey for you, Corey, and I appreciate the time and congrats on how far you've come in such a short period of time.
Well, I really appreciate those kind words, Matt. And you know, you never know where life's going to lead. Like, I didn't think that I'd be here doing, being on your podcast. I haven't listened to it for, you know, the longest time. I learned a lot about, you know, a lot of other people in the industry when, yeah, I couldn't meet anybody, right, during the pandemic. So, you kept me company. So it's nice to be on finally. I appreciate that.
I appreciate the kind words, and I'm glad you didn't take Lena to Niagara Falls.
Well,
I was like, hey, let's go to the wax museum. For people listening, if they want to get more information, if they want to find your wines or learn more about you, where's the best place, Corey? I mean, obviously you're here in Beamsville on King Street, but where do people go?
We have an Instagram. That's our primary method. We don't even have a website. We sell our wines on the Drink Collab website. So if you're interested in purchasing our wines, you can go to drinkcollab.com and search for Sempre Mio. That is our wine brand. And we have both Chardonnays and the Marsanne available now. But if you want to keep abreast of all the fun things that are happening here on the vineyard and all the cool wine things to come, you can follow us on Instagram at Sempre Mio Wines or at Mio Vineyard.
Perfect. Corey, appreciate you coming on.
I appreciate it, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, on iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.